Okay, so this meeting is on two sections, so subsections of chapter 8 of the Revolution Betrayed, which are on the Red Army and to the likes of that. So I've got a provisional title for it, which is Doctrines and Degeneration of the Red Army, which I think I sent out a few weeks ago as a suggestion, but I think that's probably a reasonable thing to talk about in terms of the subject matter of these two parts of the chapter, which is quite a long chapter, and it's got quite a few different points in it, and I think we'll be doing the conclusion of that in a couple of weeks or so, but in a few weeks anyway, but these two subsections tell a fairly simple story. It could also be called the Rise and Fall of the Revolutionary Red Army or something like that, it's about the socialist and democratic ethos of the army in the early period of the revolution, followed by its reversion to bourgeois norms as the Stalinist regime arose. And the key to understanding this is two questions. One is the militia system, and two is the abolition of ranks in the army. And it's important to understand what both of these meant and still mean, actually, because the militia system and the regular army are two very different things. The militia is territorial. It's the armed manifestation of a workers' state locally, and it depends on the active participation of the mass of the population, both in providing dedicated recruits for the militia formation, and more broadly on the population being the social base of the militia. It's the arm wing of the workers' movement in that area. It's not separated from the masses. The opposite of that is the regular army system, where the soldiers are not based in a particular locality and they move around rapidly, and in that sense are qualitatively more isolated from the local populations or from the population in general, And the latter is the preferred method of operation of bourgeois armed forces. As for the ruling class, an army that's close to and socially linked to the mass of the population is a bad idea. However, the main problem in Russia was the sheer size and technological backwardness of the country, which made this very difficult to achieve. The second question is about the question of ranks in the army, and that's not linked to the role of individuals as commanders. In an army with a revolutionary and democratic ethos, the election of officers is essential, and those elected will hopefully be those who have proven themselves the best military strategists and tacticians, the most competent organizers of military action, the most effective organizers, etc. And they have authority by virtue of their capability, but they do not have a privileged social status. And that's the point. And those are the two issues that are fundamental to these two parts of this chapter. The rise of a revolutionary army in the period of the revolution's ascent, and what happened later. But it did not claim perfection. It was a living social process, even in the rising period. As Trotsky remarked, he said, "It's unnecessary to idealize the standard of the Red Army in organization or operation during the years of the Civil War. For the young commanding staff, however, these were years of a great baptism. Rank and file soldiers of the Tsar's army, under officers and corporals, disclosed the talents of organizers and military leaders and tempered their wills in a struggle of immense scope. Among the senior, this is, sort of going on a bit, among the senior officers, about half received a higher military education, the rest a cadet course. Military theory gave them the necessary discipline of thought, but did not destroy the audacity awakened by the dramatic operations of the Civil War." So, I mean, it's really about the qualities of the commanders, as Trotsky points out, from the party, from the communist youth, and the trade unions. And he says, "These are the natural reservoir of the commanding staff. To measure the scope of this source, it is sufficient to point out that the number of those graduated from the higher educational institutions has now reached 800,000 a year. The number of college and university students exceeds 500,000, and that the general number of students in all the scholastic institutions is approaching 28 million. So Trotsky dwells on the material advances and the material shortcomings of the army. And he writes in a more general sense, he says, in the sphere of economics, and especially industry, the social revolution has provided the enterprise of national defence with advantage of which the old Russia could not dream. Planning methods mean, in the essence of the matter, a continual mobilisation of industry in the hands of the government, and make it possible to focus on the interests of defence, even in building and equipping new factories. The correlation between the living and mechanical forces of the Red Army may be considered, by and large, as on a level with the best armies of the West. And then he talks about the Navy, and he says, in January 1936, Tukhachevsky announced the accession of the Central Executive Committee. He said, "We are creating a powerful Navy. We are concentrating our forces primarily on the development of a submarine fleet. The Japanese naval staff is well informed, we may assume, as to the achievements in this sphere. No less attention is now being given to the Baltic." And on the Air Force, he said, "But the Air Fleet has advanced mightily. The Red Army is producing in increasing numbers heavy bombing planes for action on a radius of 1,200 to 1,500 kilometres. In a case of a war in the Far East, the political and military centres of Japan will be subject to attack from the Soviet coast." But he nevertheless sounds a note of caution. He somewhat says what he says. "As to the quality of the articles of military manufacture, there may be a legitimate doubt. We have noted, however, that the instruments of production are better manufactured in the Soviet Union than objects of general use. Where the purchasers are influential groups of the ruling bureaucracy, the quantity of the product rises considerably above the average level, which is still very low. Military industry remains, however, a part of the whole industry, and though to a lesser degree, reflects its inadequacies." So, in practice, the technically advanced nature of the army, in counterposition to the size and backwardness of the country, gave rise to some illusory and utopian perspectives among some of the military cadre, like the what they call the theorists of the offensive, of the export of revolution by military means as opposed to providing political leadership to the world working class. Trotsky quotes Gusev, a military Bolshevik, so-called, and a later ally of Stalin. And he said, "We are preparing the class army of the proletarians, not only for defence against the bourgeois landed counter-revolution, but also for revolutionary wars, both defensive and offensive, against the imperialist powers." And and Trotsky noted that, he said, "The author of these lines, answering Gusev in the press, called his attention to the fact that foreign military powers fulfill in a revolutionary process not a fundamental but an auxiliary role. Only in favourable circumstances can they hasten the denouement and facilitate the victory." Well, as he actually said at the time directly, he replied, "Military intervention is like the forceps of the physician. Applied in season, it can lighten the birth pains. Brought into operation prematurely, it can only cause a miscarriage." And the point being that the in practice domination of the revolutionary regular army over the militia system, which actually was the situation in practice, and the ardent cadre they produced, they trained, gave rise to these kinds of illusions. And it's also worth noting that Bukharin, who was later was the great marketizer and the leader of the right opposition, in the Civil War, he was one of the theorists of the offensive, the military Bolsheviks, as they called them, along with people like Tukhachevsky and Gusev. And Trotsky says that a school of proletarian military doctrine to which belonged or adhered Frunze, Tukhachevsky, Gusev, Voroshilov and others started from the a priori conviction that not only in its political aims but in its structure and strategy and tactic, the Red Army could have nothing in common with the national armies of the capitalist countries. The new ruling class must have in all respects a distinct military system. It remained only to create it. During the Civil War, the thing was limited, of course. The principal centre of these moves was Tsaritsyn, now Stalingrad, where Budeni, Voroshilov and afterwards Stalin began their military work. Now, these people replaced Trotsky in charge of the Red Army as the factional dispute wore on in the 20s. But their adventurist tendencies later showed a tendency to evolve into a more opportunist politics. So regarding the origins of the Red Army, Trotsky wrote this. He said, the Red Army was built anew from the first brick. A twin of the Soviet regime, it shared its fate in great things and small. It owed its incomparable superiority over the Tsar's army wholly to the great social revolution. It has not stood aside, however, from the processes of degeneration of the Soviet regime. On the contrary, these have found their most finished expression in the army. Before attempting to describe the possible role of the Red Army in a future military cataclysm, it is necessary to dwell a moment upon the evolution of its guiding ideas and structures. So there is the question of the character of the army. According to the party programme, the army should have, and it's quoting again, this is the party program. Trotsky says that he quotes it as saying, the army should have an overtly class character. That is to be composed exclusively of the proletariat and the semi-proletarian layers of the peasantry close to it. Only in connection with the abolition of classes will such a class army convert itself into a national socialist militia. And the problem being the practicalities, as mentioned before. He goes on, he says, a militia, however, no matter how well corresponding to the nature of the socialist society, requires a high economic basis. Special circumstances are built up for a regular army. A territorial army, therefore, much more directly reflects the real condition of the country. The lower the level of culture, and the sharper the distinction between village and city, the more imperfect and heterogeneous the militia. A lack of railroads, highways, water routes, together with an absence of roads and scarcity of automobiles, condemns the territorial army in the first critical weeks and months of war to extreme slowness of movement. In order to ensure a defence of the boundaries during mobilisation, strategic transfers and concentrations, it's necessary, along with the territorial detachments, to have regular troops. The Red Army was created from the very beginning as a necessary compromise between the two systems, with the emphasis on the regular troops. And he quotes the basis for this contradiction from the head of the War Department in 1924, which it's pretty obvious is actually Trotsky himself. He quotes himself saying at the time, he says, we must always have before our eyes the two circumstances. If the very possibility of going over to the militia system was first created by the establishment of a Soviet structure, still the tempo of the change is determined by the general conditions of the culture of the country, technique, means of communications, literacy, etc. The political premises for a militia are firmly established with us, whereas the economic and cultural are extremely backward. That is because, and he says again, he says, the nature and history have provided the Soviet states with open frontiers 10,000 kilometres apart, with a sparse population and bad roads. And therefore, he says, in the next few years, the creation of a militia must of necessity have a preparatory character. Each successive step must follow from the carefully verified success of the preceding steps. But, unfortunately, the isolation of the revolution and the rise of Stalinism threw such sensitive developments into reverse. Although first, before that, there was a sort of interlude where the illusion of socialism in one country actually began to seem to flower. And he quotes this. It's a funny episode. He says, but with 1925, a new era began. The advocates of the former proletarian military doctrine came to power. In its essence, the territorial army was deeply contradictory to the idea of offensivism and manoeuvrism with which this school had opened its career. But they had now begun to forget about the World Revolution. The new leaders hoped to avoid wars by neutralizing the bourgeoisie. So in the course of the next few years, 74% of the army was reorganized on a militia basis. But that was only as long as they thought that peace was on the agenda. There was a false sense of security behind that, which was punctured when Hitler came to power. At which point Trotsky notes what happened. He says, the prospect of a peaceful cohabitation with capitalism faded at once. The swift approach of military danger impelled the Soviet government, besides bringing up the numbers of the armed forces to 1,000, so to 1,300,000, to radically change the structure of the Red Army. At the present time, it contains 77% of regular or so-called Kadrovi divisions and only 23% of territorials, that is militia. The shattering of the territorial divisions looks too much like a renunciation of the militia system. Unless you forgot that an army is needed not for times of peace, but exactly for the moments of military danger. Thus, historic experience, starting from that sphere, which is least of all tolerant of jokes, has ruthlessly revealed that only so much has been gained finally and irrevocably as is guaranteed by the productive foundation of society. And then after that, the retreat became a rout. And the motivation was clear. And Trotsky says, he says, but the divisions of militia, through their very character, came into direct dependence upon the population. That's the chief advantage of the system from a socialist point of view, but it's also its danger from the point of view of the Kremlin. The keen discontent in the Red Army during the first five-year plan undoubtedly supplied a serious motive for the subsequent abolition of the territorial divisions. And then to crown it all, he says, a still more deadly blow to the principles of the October Revolution was struck by the decree restoring the officer corps in all its bourgeois magnificence. In September 1935, civilized humanity, friends and enemies alike, learned with surprise that the Red Army would now be crowned with an officer's hierarchy, beginning with lieutenant and ending with marshal. And that was justified by Mikhail Tukhachevsky in this following manner. He's quoted as saying, "The introduction by the government of military titles will create a more stable basis for the development of commanding and technical cadre." And that was contradicted by Trotsky on the basis on which the original Red Army was founded. As he pointed out this, he says, engineers and physicians have no rank, but society finds the means of putting each in his needful place. The right to a commanding position is guaranteed by study, endowment, character, experience, which need continual and moreover individual appraisal. The rank of major adds nothing to the commander of a battalion. The elevation of the five senior commanders of the Red Army to the title of marshal gives them neither new talents nor supplementary powers. It's not the army really that really thus receives a stable basis, but the officer corps, and that at the price of aloofness from the army. The reform pursues a purely political aim to give a new social weight to the officers. And of course, it has its basis in the wider degeneration of the revolution. So Trotsky says again, he says, no army can be more democratic than the regime which nourishes it. The source of bureaucratism, with its routine and swank, is not the special needs of military affairs, but the political needs of the ruling stratum. And the bourgeois press abroad took note of the real content of all this. It's There's a quote from Le Monde from September 25th, 1935, that Trotsky cited, where it said, "This external transformation is one of the signs of a deep change which is now taking place through the Soviet Union. The regime, now definitely consolidated, is gradually becoming stabilized. Revolutionary habits and customs are giving place within the Soviet family and Soviet society to the feelings and customs which continue to prevail within the so-called capitalist countries. The Soviets are becoming bourgeoised." And it's only really necessary to add that the weaknesses and backsliding of Tukhachevsky and the rest of them did not really mean that they were the finished article of the degeneration. Because you had, a bit later on, you had the destruction of the military cadre, including Tukhachevsky, who were executed by Stalin in the Great Purges, just a bit later than this, though, a couple of years later. Yeah. But they were all a stage in the degeneration, and that's the point. You know, and that's all I'm going to say for the moment. I'll open it up to discussion. I think I've talked for about half an hour anyway, so I'll leave it there. Yeah. Okay, comrades, who wants to speak?
It's a big job.
Yeah, quite a big job.
I see that Emma is here and Suzanne.
Hi.
Hello, Suzanne.
Hello, yes. Sorry. I had to go out and do some shopping, so I got back late.
Awesome.
Hi, Marie.
Hello. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Emma.
Hiya.
I say a few words, and Ian, so I don't see anybody falling over themselves to speak. I'm afraid that I think I have understood the subject, but I'm not going to find it easy to either explain or even expand on it. But I'll just give it a try. I have the impression that in during the Civil War, just before the Civil War, and for the whole duration of the Civil War, Stalin had not... was not opposed to the Red Army as Trotsky was trying to build it, mm-hmm. and for quite some years until Lenin died, he went along with the revolution which took place from below to actually change completely the structure of the army. So somewhere it's mentioned that the French Revolution, they reincorporated quite a lot of the old army, you know, the army of the monarchy before. But in this case, there was a complete sweep, and the old generals were not reincorporated. Or if they were, it was as individuals, but they were given no powers in the Soviet army. So I have the impression that for quite a few years, Stalin positioned himself a little bit on the left, like you were saying, Ian, this sort of adventurism idea. We will go abroad and we will help, we will give solidarity to revolutions I don't know how they formulated it, but the idea is that you would go, the Soviet army was not just for the Soviet Union, but for international revolution. That had been the idea of the Bolsheviks, of course. But as things were turning out, it became obvious that the armies in the other countries were not becoming revolutionary. So if you gave them support, you could only give support to bourgeois armies, and of course they were not going to do that. So the thing became an abstraction, and I think it was very good for Stalin. He liked that, so that he didn't have to, and I think it wasn't even himself clear. He went along with this idea that it was all very good to have a new army, a revolutionary army, but then the Red Army from the beginning had to make compromise between what they wanted, what they had wanted, and particularly in the world, and the fact that the world was not becoming a revolutionary. So it says somewhere the Red Army was created from the very beginning as a necessary compromise between the two systems, which is, I think, what you have explained, Ian. There was this territorial and militia aspect which came from the localities, and then of course the obvious need to defend the frontiers and to move fairly quickly, and that calls for soldiers, for an army. And so there was a compromise between the two which lasted for quite some time, but as soon as Lenin died in 1924, I think things started changing dramatically. And it is, when you think for Trotsky what it means that he had given absolutely his all to build this army which was capable of defeating all these invading armies, you know, in 1918-19, the world invaded Russia. And yet this stood up because this was a revolutionary army, and the people were involved from below, from their workplaces, in militias, as well as Trotsky was building this compromise between, and then they reincorporated some. I think they had been officials from the Tsar army, but they did not let them do what they want. They were now, these people were now helping the project of the Soviet Union to defend itself against imperialism. So that was not a reincorporation. It was an intelligent thing which did not give to these people any power over the rest of the army. I think it's such a heartbreaking thing when you think that so much was achieved, and then when in 1935-36 already Stalin came. When did he come to power? It was in 24, wasn't it? In 24, Stalin and all his crew, he comes from then, and then he... Am I speaking too long, Ian? You're muted. Okay, I'll carry on. It looks like it's okay.
No, I said carry on. I'm sorry, I wasn't...
Okay. I'll just try to finish this. In 1924, Stalin saw that he had the scene, he could take the scene. He came with his crew of other people. He came along in power, and he did not mind letting people be a bit adventurous with questions of art and of artistic innovations. But when he came to the army, he saw the need to serve his caste. It became a caste, and he influenced the army in a way to actually make it useful to his caste. And so they reintroduced the ranks, and reintroduced not generals, because people didn't want to hear about generals, but marshals. They call them marshals. And then at the end, like you said, Ian, five marshals were put at the top of the army, and there was absolutely no need. This was serving nothing. It was doing no good to the army or to the soldiers. What it was doing good to was a power which was imposing itself on the mass of the militia people who would have been in the militias, and then on society itself. So society was now being imposed upon by people who had ranks, and this retreat is heartbreaking. At the same time, I think it's important to see that it's not in the text, but they were victorious in the Second World War, nevertheless, which was not a small job. And in the Second World War, as far as I remember my readings, people who had actually known how to be somebody from below in the workplaces and on the land, who had actually learned the idea of making a militia. These people stood, that was their descendants or people who continued them, against the Nazis, fighting the Nazis body to body, you know, in the Second World War. And so, I'm sorry, this is not very good, but I have tried.
Sorry, who else wants to speak?
Well, I will say something, if that's all right. I found the complaint about the ranks very self-defeating, in the sense that I don't know what Trotsky was complaining about, in the sense that even if you have an army which is going, you know, the Russian army is created in a way that is completely different, as far as I can understand it, from any other Western army. And given that it was based, you know, it came out of the Tsarist army, the fact that it is so different is still reflected in the way that it was a revolutionary army, and it has remained so. That is to say, the officers' training is, it feels to me, is entirely based on recognized, you know, superior abilities, information abilities that are brought out of training and not out of privilege or rank. But also, the Red Army is different because, unlike most other armies of the 19th century, it was attacked from the get-go. So the Western, Britain, France, obviously Germany had been attacking it, but and America had all turned on, you know, the Russians and invaded it for the first 10 years, if you like, of its existence. And that necessarily changed how it was fighting. It was fighting on defense of both the land and the revolution, which made its ethos very different to any other. But by 1935, for me, the only purpose of the ranks, because they are so different to most other armies, is that they are about, you know, the buck stopping here. They are about final decision making. And all of the ranks, of all the officer ranks, are very, very much more involved with the day-to-day responsibilities, planning, and it's far more equal than any other army that I ever read about. Yeah, and there is no permanent ruling privilege class that are the ones which are the officer class. Yeah, they have to earn their rank all the way through, and they only earn their rank through success. So I can understand that Trotsky must have been, as the main architect of the Red Army, must have been very disappointed by the fact that he felt it was being undermined by Stalin. I do not think that without Stalin's, shall we say, reshaping it between 35, because they knew what was coming with the Nazis. Yes, I mean, Hitler had already telegraphed that the real direction of Nazi Germany would always be Russia and its, you know, vast lands and its resources and its people to be enslaved, to be workers in the factories. So it was a weapon, if you like, that had, you know, it was there for self-defense, but it was there to ensure the survival of Russia, Mother Russia. And that was really all about it. I think it feels much more about Trotsky's hurt that his dream was not going to be fashioned. I'm not sure that Trotsky's dream army would have been any more effective.
Hmm.
And I presume Trotsky wanted, above all else, that Russia and the revolution would survive.
Anybody else want to speak immediately? Because I want to come in a minute on a couple of points. Anybody else? No? Shall I come back then? Just on a couple of things. First of all, on the question of when was Stalin in power? That's an interesting question, because it was a graduation, wasn't it? It wasn't something that happened immediately. He was not Lenin's successor. There was a factional struggle that lasted until about 1930 between different fragments of the Bolsheviks, different fractions, in which Stalin was in an advantageous position at the beginning, because he was actually the general secretary of the Communist Party, and he was appointed to that job before Lenin died, you know, a couple of years before Lenin died, I think, after the death of Sverdlov, if that's right, if I'm right. Lenin actually sought his removal, but he was never actually removed, you know. In Lenin's testament, he called for Stalin to be sacked and replaced with somebody more loyal, more polite, and more capable of being a general secretary, because that never happened. It was probably hushed up, to be honest. It was not really taken up. But the thing is that there was a panoply. It was not clear who would win out. You know, Stalin had that advantageous position, but that didn't make him more powerful. There were different factions. There was people around Zinoviev and Kamenev, people around Bukharin, and they only gradually crystallized into different factions. And, of course, there was the left opposition, you know. And the left opposition came into existence, really, as a result of the scissors crisis, the economic crisis that was revealed, the divergence between agricultural prices and industrial prices, and the danger that posed to the economy. And they proposed a program of industrialization and planned industrialization. Whereas the program that won out was a program of gradual market-driven industrialization. That was Bukharin's program, which basically Stalin went along with for about 5 years, which was, what was Bukharin's slogan? We will build socialism at a snail's pace. The other. And the left opposition were denounced as super-industrializers, for wanting to have a 5-year plan 5 years earlier than the actual 5-year plan that was eventually put forward, you know, by Stalin after he broke with Bukharin, you know. But during that time, Zinoviev and Kamenev, who were the original approximate leaders of the Soviet Communist Party for a few years, was what's called the Troika, which was Zinoviev, Kamenev, and Stalin. But then Zinoviev and Kamenev were so disturbed by what was happening to the Russian economy, the Soviet economy, because of Bukharin's marketizing policies, that they broke with Stalin and joined with Trotsky in the joint opposition of 1925, I think it was, you know, 1926 rather. It lasted about a year, and they proved to be, they really were not resolute enough to stick the course. They capitulated to Stalin after about a year and a half or something, you know. But nevertheless, that was a symptom that the regime was not consolidated at that point. And then, of course, Bukharin's economic regime led to a Kulak revolt in 1928-29 and forced Stalin to break with Bukharin in a panic, because he thought, well, they're going to be overthrown by the Kulaks, you know. And they had to, you know, forced collectivization was a defensive measure by the Stalin faction to stop them, basically, stop them being overthrown by the peasantry, by the rich peasantry, you know. That's why they had to do forced collectivization. So it was a very, you know, they didn't, none of these factions, apart from Trotsky, had a coherent program of what to do about the economy and what to do about how to resolve the question of the revolution being isolated, and how to buckle down and work for the future, you know. But but Trotsky was calling for 5-year plans 5 years before there were any 5-year plans, and that is the bottom line, really, of who had a coherent policy, you know. And that sort of leads me on to Susan's point, because it was not under the regime of ranks and titles and marshals and all this sort of things that the USSR fought off 13 different imperialist armies in the original attack in the Civil War. They didn't have those things then. They just had a revolutionary army that promoted people on merit, but didn't give them fancy titles and didn't give them the conceit that they were part of a privileged layer that were better than the ranks. You know, it was an egalitarian an egalitarian structure. That's what they were. That was the ethos of the original army. What what happened when they introduced ranks in the mid 30s was basically an attempt to openly say that we need a privileged layer to actually make the thing work, you know. And of course, one of the marshals was actually Stalin himself, of course, you know. And he was the man who signed the agreement with Hitler in 1939. It's not so much that he made an agreement with Germany. That's not the problem, because it's a tactical question. Who you make a short-term agreement with is a tactical question. But it's the fact that they believed in the agreement. They believed that they got an agreement. They believed in peaceful coexistence. And that is the eternal sort of the problem of Stalinism, and it always was. Socialism in one country has a corollary. You seek peaceful coexistence with imperialism. And necessarily part of the illusion of that is that the imperialists are willing to peacefully coexist with you. But of course they're not, you know. And everything they sign in that regard is just basically a temporary agreement that will be broken at some point in the future. But Stalin believed in his bloc with Hitler. And he was extremely shocked when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union. By all accounts, he was in a state of absolute breakdown when Hitler invaded in June 1941. He said, "Well, the only person he ever trusted in his life was Hitler." You know, that's the quip. You know, and other people had to take up the battle. You know, I mean, there are other marshals actually. What's his name? That's the great Soviet marshal. His name has escaped me for the moment. But nevertheless, you know, it was not Stalin. Stalin was not the great leader of the war against Hitler. It was other people, you know, who, you know, the authority. What was the name of that guy? I can't remember his name. Zhukov, that's the man. Marshal Zhukov. He was the man who basically became was very threatening to Stalin. His prestige became enormous. He was the leader of the Red Army against Hitler, you know. And he became somebody who had to be cut down to size after the war, as is well known, you know. This whole thing about privilege and power and social status, that's what it was all about, really. And it was a retreat, you know, retreat from what was the original ethos of the Red Army. And it was, you know, things like the rehabilitation of the Russian Orthodox Church was another part of it, because the Bolsheviks were hostile to the Russian Orthodox Church, you know, because it was a repressive reactionary church. And it was it went hand in hand with the Tsarist regime, you know. But Stalin rehabilitated it. At the same time he was repressing the left opposition, he rehabilitated the church, you know. So it was a concern. That's why we object to it, you know. And we all know that the eventual outcome of the Stalinist generation is that it generated capitalist restorationist currents after the war, obviously, you know. Decades later, it gave birth to capitalist restorationist currents. It led to the collapse of the Soviet Union, but over a long period, you know. I'll leave it there. And I think Paul wants to speak. Paul.
When you meant and they were called for Stalin to be sacked when he was the general secretary, it would appear that there were signs of what Stalinism was about in that case from then on. So, yeah, I don't agree with the comments about the rankings. Because even the bourgeoisie press at the time noted about the bourgeoisie of the Red Army. So, also, since you mentioned the pact between Stalin and Hitler, it doesn't stop there though, does it? Because we now know, I suspect Stalinists will justify it in some way. They always do. But even after the war, we now know that which is very pertinent now, because the Stalinist regime were very, not only were they sending weapons to Israel from Czechoslovakia, they were all part and parcel of the whole creation of the state of Israel, and it led to the destruction of all the communist parties in the established communist parties in the Middle East. So so the comment about the pact basically led me on to Israel, because I didn't realise until very recently just how involved the regime was in that whole situation. Thanks.
Sure. Anybody else? Yeah, just on. Marie,
here. I don't know whether it's the right time to say that, but to take this on, which you just said, Ian, about socialism in one country, I see in the document it says in 1925, the advocates of the former proletarian military doctrine. So that was that semi adventurous thing, you know, and Stalin had supported that. They came to power. So he was in a position now, if he wanted to put it in practice. In its essence, the document says the territorial army was deeply contradictory to that ideal of offensivism and maneuverism with which this school, the proletarian military, had opened its career. But they had now begun to forget about the world revolution. And this is the key. This is the key. The socialism in one country was starting, or had started, and it was becoming the prevailing idea. And so now that was forgotten, so then, but perforce, you were going to have to abandon your adventurism and offensivism. This led. And I want to say that now, perhaps it's a wrong time. Eventually, it would lead not only to forgetting about the world revolution, but to want to destroy it. And this is what Stalin did in Spain and in France in particular with his policy. And in 1926 in Britain, where he took the side of the TUC, of the bureaucracy of the TUC, to call off the strike. This is where it goes. And so we have, I think, a very important opportunity here to discuss what is this degeneration that Trotsky is talking about. And he's not complaining. The last to complain was Trotsky. He never complained, even though he was threatened in his life every minute that he was writing this document. He wasn't complaining. He was analyzing this problem. Yeah. Not finished.
Sure. Anybody else? Can I just come back on Israel? Because I think that is important. I don't know whether Stalin was physically the first regime in the world to recognise Israel may well have been, you know. But I do know why the reason why they funded Israel and supported Zionism, which they came to regret actually in the 50s quite strongly, because they adopted the opposite policy. They were anti-Zionist by the sort of early 50s, but in the late 40s they backed Israel, and I know why, because it was to do with American politics and the Popular Front in the United States. And what they wanted to do is, there was an American Democratic Party politician who was actually one of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's vice presidents, was Henry Wallace. And he was both a left-wing pro-Moscow deviant bourgeois politician, but he was also pro-Zionist. And they were trying to promote him as the potential president, a Popular Front type president of the United States. His candidacy in 1948 against Harry Truman, you know, who was one of the, you know, sort of arch cold warriors, etc., and you know, one of the prime movers behind the founding of NATO in 1949. But the other guy actually advocated a block with the Soviet Union, you know, the continuation of the wartime alliance, etc., etc.
Was that Ian? Was it Wallace?
Yeah, Henry Wallace. Yes, he advocated the continuation of the wartime alliance with the USSR into the, you know, after the war, which was a policy that the American ruling class did not like at all. But Stalin did. But the problem is, he was pro-Zionist. He was a supporter of the Zionist project. So in order to promote his, it didn't work. He failed miserably. But in that period, in order to promote that Popular Front policy in the United States, Stalin backed Zionism, and he armed Zionism indirectly, slightly deniably, through the Czech. Stalinist regime that was just emerging. They were a conduit to arm Haganah and the other Jews, well, particularly Haganah, actually. I don't think they armed the extreme right, sort of the revisionists, but they armed Haganah. And they probably played a major role in the victory of the Zionists. There's no doubt about it. They got a lot of arms from the Soviet Union, channeled through the Czech Republic or through Czechoslovakia, as it was then, you know. So it was actually Stalinist politics that was behind that, you know. It was the Popular Front in the American context. That's why they did it. And actually, Truman actually capitulated to the Zionists and became... Truman was somewhat hostile to Zionism, but he was hostile to the Soviet Union. But he was brought to heel by the Zionist lobby anyway. And he completely about-faced and became the chief sponsor of it. I mean, after Stalin, at a certain point, Stalin was eclipsed as being the main sponsor by Truman, who'd done a complete 180-degree turn on... after being harangued by elements, the embryonic Zionist lobby in America, who gave him a lot of money towards his election campaign, and completely marginalised Wallace. You know, I think Wallace became a marginal figure. You know, and he won the election against a Republican opponent whose name I cannot remember. But he, you know, he was not particularly important anyway, because Truman won Truman was a successful candidate. But that's what's behind it, really. It's Popular Front politics, you know. If you do some, reading on that, you know.
Ian, this Haganah was fighting the British?
For a while it was, yes, I suppose, but it was mainly fighting the Arab armies and the Palestinians. You know, it was the core of the IDF. What became the IDF was the Haganah, wasn't it? You know, yeah.
We should go back to this because it's complicated.
It is. It's worth having a session on that at some point. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody else?
Susan, go ahead.
No,
I haven't got my hand up.
No, you haven't.
I mean, I think a lot of the support, very early support for the Zionist position was about the, it was about fighting the British, which I don't know whether, and French, but because they were seen as oppressed people and therefore it was supporting the revolution. But I think also the kibbutz were very successful in selling to the Russians the idea that this was going to be a socialist republic in the Middle East, that it was going to, you know, it was part and parcel with the socialist revolution within the Arab states themselves, because the British were busy and the French were busy putting monarchies, you know, the monarchies we've still got, as opposed to the Baathist, you know, socialist parties that that were very much less opposed, you know, that were not part of the empire system, or that they were overthrew their monarchies, as in Iran. Yeah, even if they then ended up with dictatorships. But my big feeling is that the Russians gradually became less and less keen on it because of the brain drain that was so dramatic after World War II, where as it unfolded during the late 40s and 50s, became so much more obvious they were losing their brightest and best to Israel. And this was a serious drain on the fact that they wanted people for the, you know, the space projects, as well as defending themselves from NATO aggression. So there has always been a sort of love-hate relationship between Israel itself as well as Zionism. Or is that not, has nobody else got that impression with it?
No. Paul, you wanted to speak.
They may well have, the Quebec may have been able to persuade the Soviet Union at times that it was a socialist project, but it doesn't take away the fact that most of the Arab Communist parties in the surrounding countries actually opposed the concept of Zionism, and they felt betrayed, and it led to their destruction of their own communist parties when the regime ended up backing Zionism.
Yeah, I don't think the, just to come back on that, I don't think the kibbutzim argument actually had much influence on the Russians. I think it was pure opportunism of Stalin, to be honest, and his desire for a bloc with Henry Wallace, and have a pro-American president and continue the wartime alliance. It was a forlorn hope because the American ruling class had changed its policy. But he thought there was an opportunity to do that, and that's why he went along with it. That's my understanding. But by the 50s, they'd changed their position entirely, and they were very anti-Israel, you know, and they were very much pro-Nasser when Nasser came to power in 1952, on a very anti-Israel sort of radicalization. The Soviet Union backed Nasser, and it continued to back Nasser right through the 60s and right through the 50s and the 60s until he died in 1970. You know, they were very strongly pro-Nasser, and they played a major role in denouncing Britain, France, and Israel in the Suez Crisis in 1956. So they changed utterly. But I'll tell you one thing: the kibbutzim argument actually did convince a lot of left-wing British Labourites to support Israel. People, even like, you know, up until 1982, people like Tony Benn and Eric Heffer and other, you know, Skinner perhaps, I'm not sure about Dennis Skinner, but a bunch of the Labour lefts who were very prominent in the 70s and even the 60s were all friends of Israel. And they changed their mind after the massacre of Sabra Shatila in Lebanon in 1982, that horrendous massacre that exposed Israel to the world, exposed Israel, and a lot of Labour leftists left the Labour Friends of Israel, and it became a right-wing thing, you know, and it's been ever since, you know. But originally, in the 70s, Israel was regarded by many left-wing social democrats as being something good, you know, something progressive, something socialist. It was an illusion, but it was a widespread illusion, you know. Paul, sorry.
On that point, actually, I believe many years ago, Ralph Miliband and his wife were actually members of a so-called left-wing Zionist organization. I can't remember what it was called, but there was an element of the left involved in Zionism in those days, wasn't there?
Quite a lot of it, actually.
Thanks.
Anybody else want to speak? John? You're muted.
Yeah. I just don't understand this point about why it destroyed the communist parties in the Middle East, the whole thing. Russia's, the Soviet Union's support for Israel. I don't quite get why it would have destroyed the communist parties in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the new Zionist party's aspirations were always from the river to the sea, and therefore toppling communist parties, which were popular, as opposed to monarchies, which were much more easy to corrupt and threaten because they were separated from the mass of their people, has always been the American and therefore the Zionist foreign policy. And it's only when America wanted things to be quiet so that their military bases wouldn't be under continual threat of attack. And, you know, now that we can really see that the major differences between Israel's avowed goals and how much it expects, you know, all the empires of the West, but certainly the American empire, to just throw themselves at their feet and take over and become Israel's foreign policy. No? You know, why were the Abraham Accords set up? So that Israel could have peace without actually making any concessions to anybody they wanted for any length of time. It's all about lies and cheating, making treaties and then walking away from them when it's convenient for you.
Just on that, I mean, I don't know the on the question of the Arab Communist Party, I don't know the detailed history of these parties. But it doesn't. The communist parties in the Arab
world. Oh, right. Sorry. Yeah.
The actual communist parties, the pro-Moscow parties. I don't necessarily know in detail their history, but I would guess that they would have had a very hard time from Israel's being supported by Stalin, because it would have been seen as a terrible betrayal. And it would have caused all sorts of problems. I don't know. Maybe Paul knows more about this than I do, but I don't know. But it doesn't surprise me, actually, that they would have gone into major crises over something like this, you know, because it's such a scandalous thing to happen. You know, the ethnic cleansing, Russian support for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, you know, it's absolute scandal. I mean, I know that I'm sure the mass sentiment in the Arab world was not that different from the epitomized by the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt, who sent volunteers to fight with the Palestinians against the Zionist colonizers. I suspect that is a popular, that was, I mean, they were a popular organization at the time, but I bet you that the Communist Party sentiments would have been very similar, and they would have been very, very upset about the support of Stalin for Zionism. But we'd have to do some research into that, because I don't really know. What was the other question I was going to address? I don't know. I'll leave it there for a bit. It'll come back to me. Paul wants to speak. Yeah.
Yeah, I first found out about it from I saw haven't think of that because it was so long. There was a long article posted in one of our chats that were most of us were in about, I think it was called In Defense of Marxism, and there was a long article about the fact that Stalin did support Zionism. I don't know if it mentioned the American situation, but from that, you know, I discovered that there was a whole series of Arab parties, communist parties in that region, but they were all opposed to the concept of Zionism, you know, because obviously they saw it as anti-working class and no doubt racist. And, so if, you know, if the Soviet Union turned around and said, well we're going to defend it, that's inevitably going to cause a rift with the existing communist parties in the area that oppose Zionism. So that's what I based that on. I just need to find that article again. It was an article that Toran shared quite a while ago.
Right.
In one of the chats. I can't remember whether it was the Sunday meeting chat or the LCFI chat.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to have a look around, but it's in one of the chats.
Mm-hmm. What was the other point I was going to say? I can't remember. Anybody else want to speak?
I'm putting on the chat something I've found about Stalin and Zionism.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I'm putting it now. Perhaps this is what Paul meant.
Let's have a look at that. Yeah, that might be the one. I don't know.
Is that right, Paul?
Give me a moment, I'll have a look.
So perhaps we should continue that discussion at some time.
Yeah, maybe we should, actually. Is there anything else people want to say about the subject matter of this point on the main points on the agenda? About the Trotsky piece or anything related to it or related to this discussion? If not, should we stop the recording and carry on?
The last thing I was going to say is, do you see any... There's been a lot of talk in Russia now about rehabilitating Stalin.
Right.
Do you see any sign of there being a rehabilitation of Trotsky?
That's a good question. I don't think...
Well, I'm asking because... While people in the West sort of go, well, how can you rehabilitate Stalin? They must be, you know, it must be that these things are going on. But my impression was that Trotsky was rehabilitated quite a long time ago, but perhaps not in the way that the Trotskyists in other parts of Europe expected.
I just come back on that. I don't see Stalin or Trotsky as persona non grata in Russia today. You know, I mean...
I wouldn't, yeah.
Yeah, they are both... I mean, the government in power is a Christian centre-right government, and it doesn't really... It's not virulently hostile to either Trotsky or Stalin, but it is... it's not politically in tune with either. You know, I mean, the Communist Party of the Russian Federation is probably more Stalinist. But I mean, there are people. No one believes that Trotsky was an agent of imperialism, apart from some really strange cultist elements that are still left over. But no one really believes that. You know, there are criticisms of both contemporary Trotskyism and contemporary, you know, official communism in the West, some of which are both is are defending Russia, and quite a lot of both are not defending Russia and have got terrible positions. You know, the Greek Communist Party has got an appalling position on the war in Ukraine. You know, it basically supports NATO, but so does bloody the United Secretariat of the Fourth International. You know, I don't see that they're seen as particularly different. I think the divisions are now are on different lines, and people, you know, we have a fraternal relationship with the new Communist Party, which defends Russia. Now, of course, it's got reformist baggage and Stalinist baggage and whatever. And it's, you know, the relationship is not easy, not simple anyway, but the divisions are on different lines now, I think. You know, it's not, the point is that Trotskyism is worthwhile because it provided a foresight of this stuff and a systemic analysis, whereas there are weaknesses in the Stalinists don't really understand the history, and therefore that, you know, those who do not understand history are prone to repeat it, to slightly soften the classic phrase, you know, if you don't understand history you've got a problem, you know. But nevertheless, somebody, you know, there is a division on different lines now, and it's not just Stalinism versus Trotskyism. You know, that was revolution versus reform, or evolution versus counter-evolution. Now you have anti-imperialism versus pro-imperialism, and you have a much more complex sort of political scene, I think. You know, that's why we're talking to the new Communist Party, and attending forums with different communist trends, including ex-Maoists and such like, you know. And at the same time, we're talking to the Spartacist League, you know, for trying to, you know. It's much more varied, I think. You know. So, I don't know.
Can I say something about that, Jan?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, about this, the way I see it is that, for example, the Communist Party that we saw a few days ago, the new Communist Party of the CEO, and I know others, you know, they are sort of incapable of understanding bureaucracy. For them, bureaucracy is what they see in the trade unions, but they do not see it in the way in which it happened to replace when the Soviets took power, and then they were dislodged from power, and yet capitalism didn't come back because capitalism did not have the strength to come back because the revolution had been very complete. So there came some sort of layer in society which is not capitalist and which is not communist. And I think without Trotsky, nobody has analyzed this. And so the communists of today, they are all divided. They realize that there was a degeneration in the Soviet Union, in the communist parties, but they cannot place when it happened. So they will tell you it was with Khrushchev, or they'll tell you it was with another date. They call it revisionism, yeah? And then they accuse Albania or China, I don't know. but the problem is with Stalin. And, you know, this is almost impossible for them to accept, you know. And I remember having had an article in which I talked about Trotsky in the New Worker of the CO paper. So Andy had put it in. And the next issue, they put a great big picture of Stalin on the front page. You know, it's just like they cannot understand, don't want to, and they cannot understand. And so I think this is what's happening in part to Theo particularly, that he feels something is escaping him. Every person he meets is some kind of Trotskyist. There is no more now new Stalinists appearing as big groups. This is not happening. And so he wants to cling to what he has because this is the only thing he knows. Yeah, that's the way I see it.
Mm-hmm. Paul?
Probably why he doesn't like the fact that I don't care of the IUF actually. on a more serious note, that event that the NCP had, was there a Zoom component to it that was recorded, or was it an in-person event only?
I think it wasn't recorded. I don't think it was. It wasn't. Okay, there was a couple of people who came in by Zoom, but it was a hybrid.
So it was a hybrid event.
It was hybrid, but it was also a private event they organised. We were invited in person, you know.
Because I saw the email that went onto the LTFI email list, so I didn't know about it.
Invited in person, but in practice they'd established a hybrid link as well. I wasn't aware of that.
That's a shame, because I would have liked to have gone if that was the case. My second question is, now that the election's over, and I think that's what the debate was about, wasn't it? It was about are the NCP still insisting that supporting Labour was the right thing to do? The Labour Party, I mean.
Well, I think they are, but they're sort of a bit lukewarm about it, and they're not consistent, because Theo actually went and worked for Emmerdale Code in the general election, because he lives in their area.
He told me about that. He said he had to get permission to do that.
So I think they're not consistent. They're not that dogmatic, but they have got that same position, Can I suggest this? I think we start the recording now and we have a discussion about what we have in the next meeting. Yeah? Is that all right with comrades? Yeah? Okay, I'll stop the recording.